would like to read you a passage from Scripture that I would like to reflect on a little bit today. And it's a passage that at first might not seem to be so special, but maybe if I open it up a little bit, you might discover that some of that is what we are living constantly, or trying to live. This is taken from the Gospel of Luke. Now it happened in those days that Jesus went onto the mountain to pray. And he spent the whole night in communion with God. And when day came, he summoned his disciples and picked out 12 of them. He called them apostles. Simon, whom he called Peter, and his brother Andrew, James, John, Philip, Bartholomew, Matthew, Thomas, James, son of Alphaeus, Simon called the Zealot, Judas, son of James, and Judas Iscariot, who became a traitor. He then came down with them and stopped at a piece of level ground where there was a large gathering of his disciples with a great crowd of people from all parts of Judea and Jerusalem and the coastal region of Tyre and Sidon who had come to hear him and be cured of their diseases. People tormented by unclean spirits were also cured. And everyone in the crowd was trying to touch him because power came out of him that cured them all. I hope that you can hear me even when I walk away from this. I think I'm wired up well, okay? I would like to talk about this a little bit because this text, to me, particularly during the last few months, has become very important. And I want you to see this text as sort of concentric circles. Jesus went onto the mountain and spent the whole night in communion with God, and that's the center of the circle. He spent the whole night in communion with God. And when day came, he came down from the mountain and he gathered around him 12 disciples, 12 apostles. And you hear the names. And the last name you hear is Judas Iscariot, who would become his traitor. It's important to see that the second circle is the circle of people who form community with Jesus. And then with the 12, he came down and went to level ground, and there people from all over gathered. His disciples and people from the different regions. And he started to minister to them with his word and with his healing ministry. So you have this image of Jesus alone with the Father, with God, Jesus with his apostles. And together with his apostles, you see him ministering to the people all around. And for me, that can be summarized in three words. The words communion, the words community, and the word ministry. Jesus spent the whole night in communion with God. In the morning, he formed community with his apostles. And in the afternoon, he went out and ministered in community to the people who gather. And I have a sense that our lives, whatever they are and however we live them, are lives in which we are called to those three realities, to communion, to community, and to ministry. And I just want to say a few words about all three and how they are related. And I would like to very simply ask you to for a moment enter into that place where Jesus is alone with God, where he enters in communion with his Father. And I would like you to even realize that word Father has the quality that embraces motherhood, sisterhood, brotherhood. It's a word that if you enter it more deeply, you will realize that it embraces all the forms of human love that we possibly know. The love of a father, the love of a mother, of a brother, a sister, of a friend, or a lover. It's a very rich word. It's a very intimate word that breaks right through a lot of patriarchal patterns that might have existed in that society. But when Jesus enters in communion with his Father, he enters in communion with the source of love, of which we get glimpses in fatherhood and motherhood and brotherhood and sisterhood and teacher and all the relationships that we know. All fatherhood, all motherhood, all teacherhood, all care, they are reflections and reflections of that divine love that Jesus communes with. And I very much would like you to realize that when Jesus speaks to us about believing in him, he asks us, in fact, to believe in that relationship with the one he communes with. He is in communion with. Do you believe in me? Doesn't mean, do you believe in me as being able to do all these things? No, it means, do you believe that I am the one who comes from the Father, who is sent by the Father, who is sent by the God of love? Do you believe that I am the one who comes from above? Do you believe that everything I say because I have heard it said by the one who sent me? Do you believe that anything I do not do on my own, but I do it because I am sent to do it by the one who brought me here? Do you believe that all the splendor and the glory you see is not my own, but is given to me by the one who sent me? Do you believe that everything I say, everything I do, everything I think or am is in relationship, is part of a communion? Do you believe that I am the Son, the one who is sent, the one who is only with you because of that relationship, of that intimacy, of that connectedness? Do you believe that I am so connected with the one who sent me that connectedness itself is divine? That communion itself is so real that it has a name called spirit. That communion that exists between me and the one who sent me is a breath, an intimacy, a breathing between two lovers that is so total that Father and Son does no longer mean difference, but only equality. that the Father is not more powerful than I am, more in control than I am, has more power than I am. No, the Father and I am one. We are totally unique and totally mutual. And that mutuality and that breathing and that intimacy and that connectedness is called spirit. And it is that spirit that I come to bring to you. I want you to participate in that intimacy, in that communion. I come to you so that my spirit can be yours. It's good for you, finally, that I leave, because when I leave, I can send you my spirit. And my spirit will lead you to the full truth. Truth means betrothal, to the full communion, to the full intimacy. I come so that you can become son and daughter of my Father, of my Mother, of my Lover, in the same intimate way as I am, the Son, the Child. And that's what I think is so important. And when you see that Jesus goes up onto the mountain to pray, he goes up into the mountain to fully taste that communion. He entered into communion with God, the scripture says. That's what prayer is about. He was there to listen to the voice that says, "You are my beloved, on you my favor rests." He entered into that prayer to be completely absorbed in that intimacy that gives him this total sense of belonging, this total sense of safety, this total sense of at-homeness. And I say this to you because I am convinced more than ever that you and I are called to that communion. And it is only to the degree that you taste that communion that you will ever be able to enter into the complexity of a human society without becoming a manipulative and violent person. And maybe it's good for you to realize one thing, and that's hard for me to say, but I'm going to say it anyhow, that Jesus entered in communion during the night. Now that word night doesn't simply mean that the sun doesn't shine. The word night means a lot. That Jesus entered into communion with God during the night, that means that he might not always be able to feel that community or to understand it. Because the communion with God transcends all our thinking and our feeling. Because God is greater than our heart and our mind. And the night means that communion with God doesn't simply mean we feel warm or have wonderful insights. To enter into the night means that we know in face and in darkness that we belong, even when our mind and our heart aren't able to grasp it. And it's precisely in the night that we therefore are tempted often to go somewhere else because we don't feel it. I'm not in communion with God, I don't feel it, I don't think about it creatively. Maybe I should have a little power in the world. Maybe I should have some successes to convince me that I am a worthwhile person. Maybe I should be sure that I have a good name and be popular. It's precisely in the night that the temptations are there to become successful, to become popular, to become powerful, and find communion through success, through popularity and through power. That's what we're always tempted to do. We have our heart craves and craves and craves for communion. But when we don't feel it and we don't see it and it doesn't make us feel warm and intimate, then we quickly say, well, we better get some success, some popularity and some power so that at least we have a little bit of a feeling what it is to be in communion. That's a temptation. And Jesus went into the desert to fight that temptation. And it was only after he had overcome that temptation and had said no 3 times that he came out of the desert and formed community. He could only form community when he had detached himself from the desire for success, popularity, and power, and he could then let community grow out of the true communion. So let me say a few words about community. Community, in a way, is the concrete human way in which we live out our communion. Now, look at history. Now, I'm coming from a Catholic tradition, and maybe I know a little bit more about some of the saints in my tradition than about others, but every time I study the life of a great saint, Saint Francis, or Saint Benedict, or Saint Ignatius, or Saint Teresa of Avila, or Dorothy Day, or every time I study these lives, I realize that these people always formed community as a fruit of their communion. Saint Francis spent days and months alone in prayer before any type of community developed. Saint Benedict wasn't even interested in community. He was in the cave, and these people came bothering him and said, hey, Father, we want to live with you. And he said, well, listen, I want to be with God. He said, no, we want to be with you. We want to have some of that, feel some of that communion in ourselves. And he said, okay, and let's have a few rules here. And Ignatius, you know, he went to Manresa and he was totally overwhelmed by God's presence. And then he went to study in Paris, and people started to sense that this man was in touch with something that they were not. And people started to gather around him, and community started to develop. And contemporary people, same thing. Teresa of Avila was in constant mystical communion, and it's out of that that she had the power and the strength to live these terrible, difficult relationships with people. Because it wasn't easy to do what she did in a century where monastic life was degenerate in many ways. And look at Bonhoeffer, to take another example from the Lutheran tradition. See how his spiritual life made him the desire for a life together. And I think you will see it in the Quaker tradition. You will see it I spend a lot of time in Pendle Hill, and what you see there is basically that as soon as people are getting a glimpse of the light, the inner light, they don't run off by themselves, but they somehow want other people to become part of something new and form community. So in a way, community sort of is the fruit of communion. As soon as you have experienced communion and you enter into the human reality, you call people, or people gather around you and each other and form community. And so community becomes, in a way, the place where that communion is being lived out day by day. And at the same time, community the place where you're always being reminded that it cannot offer you what your heart most desires. There will always be that one discordant note in it that forces you to realize that while community is the place where you live out communion, it's also the place where the person lives who makes you aware that real communion is with God and not with people. As I said earlier, community is the place where the person you least want to live with always lives. And that's why it's so fascinating that right there when Jesus calls the 12 disciples together, the last word is, and the 12th was Judas, who was to become his traitor. And I'm not that that's very strong, but there's always that jarring note. There is always that place. And look what happened with Jesus. They all leave him. And Jesus says it, you all will be scattered. And you all will go all over the place. But my Father will never leave me alone. And in fact, and I want to say this to you, you need community. You really need community. Without community, your life will be isolated. And at the same time, community is the place of your purification, of your sanctification. Because in community, you are tested constantly to not expect from another human being what only God can give. And in a way, community living, as important as it is to let the light of God and the communion of God become known to the world, at the same time, it's the place that calls you right back to that communion. The longer you live community, the more you know you have to spend the nights in communion with God. Precisely because the community calls you always back to the source of it. And so it's that mystery of communion leads to community, but community always calls you to a deeper, 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 deeper level of communion, because community is the place of detachment, of not wanting it all for yourself, of having to let go of a lot of things you're attached to, of being willing to live with people with characters that you never thought you would survive with, of being able to be with people who are very different in cultural style, in eating habits, in manners of speaking, and so forth. And I think it's really important to realize that community then is the place where you live out communion, and also where that communion is to be purified. And as the longer you live in community, the more you've been called to that place with God alone. And therefore, solitude and community can never, never be separate. Solitude is the place on the mountaintop where you enter in communion with God, and it brings you back to community, and community calls you back to the mountaintop. He belongs to God. But once you are in touch with that, then you start realizing that as people who live out communion in community, you call to minister. Suddenly you realize that community becomes the place from where you are going out and proclaim good news and heal the sick and the broken. And that's the great, great mystery. Jesus did not minister individual, alone. Jesus did not minister as a great hero who could do it all. From the very beginning, he ministered together. And we live in a world where ministry in many ways has become highly individualized. I'm a minister and I'm ministering to you. But Jesus' vision on ministry is very communal. He sent them out two by two, so that nobody would ever come to the illusion that he or she alone is the full instrument of God's love. In fact, the love becomes visible in the two who travel together, and it's in between them that the reality of the good news becomes visible. It's always interesting to me that every minister I know has a lot of characteristics that allow me to disclaim what he has to say. Well, you know, I know you a little bit. You talk about love, but I saw you yesterday too. And you talk about forgiveness, and I know what's happening in your family. And okay, that's true. Jesus sent them out two by two, because that allows us not to play games with the good news that is larger than this person or that person, who are both broken, weak, and sinful. But together, they are people who live, called to forgive each other constantly for the brokenness, and in their mutual forgiveness are able to communicate a love that is much larger than any one of them can represent. We are called to minister in community. 2, 3, 4, or whatever it means. And what community concretely means is different for different people, but that's a central theme. And what are we called to minister? What are we called to proclaim? What are we called to hear? And I think what we are called to proclaim as a community is precisely that the communion from where we come is a communion that God wants to offer to all people. That the spirit of love that belongs to God is for all people. And that we who have touched into that reality want to proclaim to the world that the Spirit of God blows where it's wanted. And that Spirit is to be given to all people and all nations. Through healing, true liberation comes from the awareness that God offers us full communion, so full that we are able to live in a world and forgive one another for not being able to give to us the communion our heart craves for. We are proclaiming to people that the love that they crave for is there for them. We are proclaiming to people that they are created with a heart that craves for a love that is available to them. And that is a love that God offers them. And when they are just willing to claim that love, they will be able to forgive one another for not being God and for not being perfect and for not being able to heal all wounds and take all loneliness away. I can live with my wounds in the community. I can live with my brokenness among people precisely because I know that beyond my brokenness and beyond the conflict and beyond the pain, I'm held safe from all eternity in a love that will never leave. And it is with that love that I have to stay in touch. And the members of my community are the people who I ask to call me back to that love. Their brokenness and my brokenness are in fact instruments for the call to a deeper community. I want to conclude by saying something about ministry right now. And I just want you to know, and you know it already, that our lives, your and my life, has radically changed during the last few weeks. Because all that we live, we suddenly live in the context of a world at war. And what is happening in the Gulf is affecting you and me in levels we aren't even fully aware of. There is a darkness there that pervades our unconscious life in ways that is very subtle, and very dark, and very dangerous. And the question that you have as a community and that I have as a community is, how are we going to live in the coming year and minister to one another and proclaim the first love of God in the midst of a world that is in full agony? And I want to say one little thing about that to you as a sort of a conclusion this morning. And that's a very simple thing. The first responsibility that you have and that I have and that we have for one another is not so much to change the world, but to prevent the world from changing us. It was this prophet who went on and for many years, and he walked through the city of sinful people, and he prophesied and prophesied and prophesied that change your behavior, shape up, get better, don't sin anymore, you're doing awful things, terrible, terrible, terrible things, and change, because you're sinners. And he was doing that for 5 years, and nobody changed. Everybody was still doing the old thing. And he was just screaming and doing this thing. And there was this little boy and said, "Hey, prophet, tell me now, you've been doing this now for 5 years, and nobody is changing a bit. So why don't you stop?" He said, "Oh, little boy, I'm not prophesying to change the world. I'm just prophesying to prevent the world from changing me." And I want you to hear that, because that's where it starts. I'm not saying that's where it ends. That's where it starts. It starts that you have to be very careful that the television and the newscast and the dark news that pounds on your heart day after day are not coarsening your heart so that you lose communion. And that one of the greatest tasks you and I have is to not let the darkness of the Scots and the Patriots and the incredible things that are happening somewhere take away from you that connection and that at-homeness and that sense of belonging that gives you the strength to proclaim something at all. And the first task is that you have to be very aware in how far you allow the darkness of the world to rip out from you what is most precious, that is communion and community and ministry. That all follow. And I think that the question, therefore, is the question that Jesus keeps saying. Nation is against nation, and people will die of fear, and people will be seduced to debauchery and drunkenness and the cares of life. Well, that's what it means, watching all this happening blow by blow. But you pray unceasingly. That means stay in communion to survive what is going to happen. To be able to stand in the midst of it all with open eyes and to keep your head erect in the presence of the Son of Man. And so if I say what is our ministry to one another and to the world, is not first of all to sort of change the war, stop the war, prevent the war. All of that is very important. But first of all, to hold our heart close to the truth of who we are, to keep holding on to the mystery that we are the children of God, that we belong to the house of God, that that's where our identity is. And from that place of communion, we can say things that are prophetic. And we can call for an end to this war. And we can proclaim that this war is evil and unjust, and we can do it, but we cannot. We can do it with a heart that is in communion, that is free, and that does not need the world to change so that we feel good, or that we enter communion, because we don't receive communion for making the world change. We receive communion on the mountaintop. And from that place, we create community, and from that place, we walk into the world and call with a free heart for change. And people will change when they see someone who is so free that change is not a condition for the prophet's own communion. And I wish to you, therefore, that as a community of Earlham College and as a community of Daybreak, we want to think about how to continue to hold on to communion. And then from that place, to ask each other, what are we called to do? Thank you so much for listening to me and for your friendship.